This is the Soil Sense podcast, where we believe that building healthier soils is not just a prescription, but rather a pursuit. It's a journey that requires collaboration, curiosity, and communication among farmers, researchers, agronomists, consultants, and extension. You're going to hear their stories and discover how and why they're working together to make sense out of what's happening in the soil. Hey there, welcome back to another episode of Soil Sense. I'm your host, Tim Hamrich. On today's episode, Dr. Abby Wick and I sit down with Dr. Jordan Wade, who's an assistant professor of soil health and soil fertility at the University of Missouri. Jordan is also the director of the Soil Health Assessment Center, which is one of the few places in the U.S. that offer the full gamut of soil health measurements. The USDA and the Soil Health Institute have both put together lists of these relevant soil health measurements. Jordan told us there's anywhere from 12 to 20 of these measurements, depending on how you look at things. But the Soil Health Assessment Center, or SHAC, as they call it for short, is one of the only, if not the only, lab in the U.S. to offer all of these measurements. And these empirical ways of measuring soil health is exactly what Jordan and Abby and I are going to spend most of today's episode exploring, from aggregate stability to organic matter to microbial biomass and beyond. So buckle up. Here's our interview with Dr. Jordan Wade.
Our Soil Health Assessment Center here is actually a really good kind of long-term investment that Missouri, both the university and external stakeholders, have made in soil health. So, you know, it has its roots as a soil characterization lab back in the 1980s. And then around about 2013, 2015, somewhere in there, you know, people said, hey, this soil health thing is really taking off. We should probably pivot. And so now we have this wonderful kind of confluence of things there. And we run around 20,000 samples per year for customers, whether they're farmers or whether they're researchers or our local NRCS offices, et cetera. And then also one of the cool things that we have that kind of illustrates this buy-in is that Missouri has a cover crop cost share, and we get samples in from every single one of those cover crop cost shares. So we can bring those together for a fairly thorough soil health assessment. You know, now we have a good picture of what soil health looks like around the state.
And why is that important? You know, for you all, obviously it's important for the farmers to get back their own soil health data, but why is it helpful for you to have a good picture of soil health around the state?
Yeah, well, you know, Missouri has a really kind of complicated landscape up north. We're glaciated soils, so it's kind of like Iowa. It's like northern Missouri, southern Iowa. You got some undulating hills, but then, you know, in the south, down in the Boot Heel, we've got high production. You know, we're growing very different things, and it can go everything from gumbo soil to sandy soils in a couple hundred yards. And so, you know, there's all of this kind of heterogeneity across Missouri, to say nothing of our climatic north to south and east to west gradient. And so we really want to be able to get that holistic picture from around the state, you know, all of our ag producing regions. And so we're getting a good picture of that right now with what we currently have. And you know, it gives us a lot more insight into that context specificity than if we were to be, say, referencing a national database or something like that. You know, we just have so much information, so much granularity from those samples that are coming in. We have a management survey that goes with it. And so we get to, you know, ask about manuring history, cover crops, no-till, rotation, all that kind of stuff. And we really get to bring all of those pieces together in a really rich way that the University of Missouri and external stakeholders are investing in soil health, and this is where it's paying off.
Man, so what are you seeing as like the kind of the important parameters that are surfacing from this northern glaciated part and then the southern really productive part? Are there certain parameters that you're like, oh wow, this is really important, I like this one, it's indicative of the management across that gradient?
Yeah, well, so, you know, that word importance, I'm gonna like jump on that because like importance kind of is in the eye of the beholder a little bit. And the thing that we don't have right now, you know, we can say, here's how management changes our soil health measurements, but we don't know how that kind of then gets reflected further on down the line. Does that mean you're more resilient to drought? Does that mean you're more productive? Does that mean you decrease your fertilizer? Does that mean you have changes in, you know, soil-borne pest pressure? We don't know that part yet. Right now, we are kind of building that database, and then we also are conducting on-farm trials to kind of get at the kind of so what question, right? Okay, you do this management, what do you expect to happen? And so that's kind of the piece that we're working on right now. And we've got, here in Missouri at least, you know, we've got a fantastic network of collaborators through Extension and also everything from our local co-ops. And, you know, everyone in Missouri is really excited about soil health, and we are more than happy to work with them, because we are too.
And when you say everybody's excited about it, you know, that's something I wanted to ask you about, is looking at the data. There are probably reasons to be excited, but there are also probably reasons to temper expectations. And can you maybe talk about that? Like, what gets you excited by what you're seeing in the data? And where would you kind of temper other people's expectations as they're getting really, really excited about this field?
Yeah, well, you know, the reason I think people are getting excited is because they're out there in the field often seeing those changes. And, you know, after a couple years of investing in whatever type of management practice. Now, from the data, that often shows up in these huge changes. Again, we're not sure how those translate further down the line, but, you know, people are excited about it because Missouri here, we have very unique soils. So we've got this difficult combination of shallow topsoil. We have a clay pan at around a foot to 18 inches. So we have a really shallow rooting zone, and we also have really intermittent rain. So that combination makes it so, you know, if it's a wet year, we'll be super productive, but if it's a dry year, we might not. And soil health really, you know, in these measurements are really helping us kind of bridge that gap and to try and say, hey, are we giving ourselves more resilience and that type of thing? You know, we're really at a crossroads here in Missouri in terms of climate and soil types. I always say that farming in Missouri is playing the farming game on hard mode, because shallow soils and drought-prone weather is tough.
So could you walk us through, I would love to hear about, like, say you're looking at the organic matter percentage number on a soil test, right? What does that mean to a farmer? They know it's important and it's part of soil health, but what should they take away from that specific number, or in the context of the sample collection, what do they need to know?
Yeah, well, you know, organic matter is the number that everyone is really familiar with. And so, you know, that's a percentage, and organic matter is, it's only a small part of soil, but it's really hard to move the needle on that, right? Building organic matter is a really difficult process because you have some coming in and some leaving. And so the analogy that I like to use is, like, if we were to look at the population of, I often use Columbia, Missouri, because we're a college town, but we can also use Green Bay, because I know a lot of your listeners are a little bit higher. You know, if you measure the population of Green Bay on a game day, you are going to have a really high number of people kind of in that city at that moment in time, right? But you could measure it the next day and it's going to be much smaller. And then the next day it might be smaller as people leave town or whatever. And I think of organic matter as the same way. People come in and people come out, or organic matter content comes in, organic inputs rather, come in and come out. And, you know, that doesn't mean that they're going to necessarily stick around, which is the thing that people are often trying to do, right? And so similar to, if you want to build the population of Green Bay, you know, you do things to keep people there, things like infrastructure, or, you know, oh, we got a really good school system, or whatever it might be. Similarly, in our soils, I like to think about it as, we got to make sure that we're keeping that organic matter around if we want to build it, right? We have to have those conditions. And those conditions vary kind of from place to place a little bit.
Okay, so you're talking like aggregates and things like that as like housing for organic matter?
Yeah, you could think of it as like aggregates as, yeah, that kind of housing. There's also just microbial community and how used to seeing that input they are. More diversified stuff going into the soil makes it so they've got to react to all different inputs, and so they don't necessarily convert it as easily, right? So that's why things like diversified rotations are really helpful in building something like organic matter.
And with something like organic matter that you said fluctuates because it goes up and down, like on game day in Green Bay, how do we know that this is just one point in time, or that we're really actually making any progress?
Yeah. And so this is a great question. A lot of people like to think about this, you know, they say you should sample at the same time every year. And that's one way to make sure that you're comparing apples to apples, or kind of, right? Also, this is where these soil health measurements come in, is we try and say, We have total organic matter, and that's really hard to move the needle. And it's also maybe not the one that's most of interest. So then we're trying to maybe look at even a subset of that and say, this one does X, Y, or Z thing, and therefore, you know, we want that to go up or down or what have you.
And is there any specific metric with these soil health tests that you wish farmers paid more attention to? Anything that you think is maybe underappreciated when it comes to health metric, or is that really organic matter kind of what it gets back to?
No, my one that I kind of love to champion is aggregate stability, which is one of the ones that's on our suite that we offer. But aggregate stability is probably my favorite. I think that it covers all manner of things, right? It integrates the chemical and the physical components here. And then it also, you know, kind of gives a proxy for erosion potential, like how much is that soil going to wash down into the gully when you got a big rain event? And it also gives us some idea of, are you building that organic matter, right? As we were kind of talking about, is that's the housing for organic matter, right? It's kind of the shell that keeps it there.
Well, aggregate stability is one of my favorite parameters too. I feel like you can send it off for a soil test, or in the field, you can kind of evaluate your aggregate stability. And so if a farmer's in the field and they may not have sent the sample off, but they're in the field looking at aggregates, they may be in a high clay soil or sandy soil, what would you have them look for? And what should they expect when they're looking at those soils?
Well, you know, aggregate stability, we have the lab measure and that is all well and good. But I think aggregate stability, one of the cool things about it is you can look at it kind of out in the field, right? I like to just kind of pick it up and you can kind of shake it in your hand and see them form a little bit, and then you can press on them and see, you know, how easily they crumble. That's a pretty easy one. You can also do, they have like this classic kind of slake test, which is you basically put it in some water and see how quickly the water clouds up. That's another one. In terms of the differing textures, right? The sandier your soil, the harder it is to kind of detect that with the naked eye. You know, most of the action happens in clays, and so that clay doesn't form aggregates as well and blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, more sand makes your job harder. So that's where the more sand you have, probably the more helpful a lab-based measurement might be.
With the amount of samples you're getting in, do you have any kind of common mistakes or best practices when it comes to soil sampling that you wish more farmers embraced?
Yeah. You know, I think the thing for me is always that, one, I would like better representation of like where you took that sample. I'm not a huge advocate of everyone going out and doing high intensity soil health testing every year. I think that we want to be very targeted, right? And so in the same way that we have, say, grid sampling with soil fertility, kind of standard soil fertility measurements, I think that a lot of these soil health measurements can be done, I mean, basically at the same density, you know, both in the timing and in terms of the spatial density. And so I think bringing those two things together, you know, people can think of that sampling as very interchangeable. Now, soil health sampling, you know, you might have a kind of different intention for it than you might for soil fertility. Soil health, you're trying to maybe go out and say, what's going on with this problem spot, right? It's a low spot, or maybe it's just a spot that's always, you know, you have worse establishment or whatever. And soil health measurements can kind of help you diagnose a little bit. You know, they give you additional information over, say, your standard soil fertility test. So that's one way that you can use it, right? We can't just go out and have that one size fits all soil health approach or test. And, you know, I think of them as, these are truly decision support tools. And now my job as a researcher is to be able to make those decision support tools, well, usable, right? And make them so they're actually useful and robust. That's pretty much how I see my job, my mission, and also the mission of kind of this center that I'm the director of.
And can you talk about how you do that? So we've talked a lot about the testing, the sampling, what you're looking for, but how do you make them more actionable rather than just a piece of paper they get in the mail?
Yeah. Well, you know, like soil health research in general, this is a little bit of a quibble I have with it, we'll say, is a lot of times they go out and they measure the soil health things and they say, all right, job well done, right? And they think that's their job is done. But to me, that's just where we get started. you take the measurements, but why are you taking those measurements, right? And farmers ask that question. And so to me, that's where we kind of start to translate those things to. Do you decrease your nitrogen application? Are you going to, you know, have greater resilience there, right? Are you going to have better yield stability? What's your disease pressure going to look like? Those types of things. Those soil health indicators are supposed to be used. Like, it is a good question of what do they indicate, but they indicate something that people want to know, right? And those people are farmers, and those farmers want it for a reason. There has to be some sort of outcome, and we need to, as researchers, and you know, this is how I see my job, is to be able to provide that information and make it really actionable.
So we talked about the farmers being the end users of the information, but there's also, you know, the group of food and beverage companies, and we've had some interviews with them, you know, on SoilSense, or people that are working on scaling, you know, these practices up and understanding, you know, carbon in the soil. And so how then, you know, can you take this really robust information you're gathering and make it usable to those audiences or able to be scaled?
This is absolutely fantastic question. So, you know, a lot of times when we're looking for some sort of certification, kind of inherent in that is we want to just check a box. You know, we say, hey, people are using no-till and therefore our job is done. But, you know, if you looked at something like potatoes, no-till potatoes are maybe not the thing you want to check a box, right? Harvesting potatoes is going to be pretty intensive on the soil. You can't no-till it. And so soil health indicators help us understand that context and peel it back a little bit more and tell us, or a food and beverage company, right, is this management right for this context? And that is really kind of one of the upsides to me of these, is if we're doing our job right, we should be able to capture both that inherent context, right, that static property, and understand the part that's kind of variable, that's under a land manager's control. And so, you know, that'll be the thing that maybe is of interest both to farmers and, you know, these food and beverage companies, is how do we differentiate between those things? How are we making a fair apples to apples comparison, even if it is Granny Smith to Red Delicious apples?
So I imagine, Jordan, you're similar to me as a scientist, where, you know, more detail is better, right? And when we really want to understand and dive deep into something. But what does it look like in, you know, the world of trying to estimate carbon or increases in soil carbon in the soil? Or what does it look like when it has to be just good enough? When I looked at organic matter as a scientist, I split that organic matter into every possible pool, the stuff that was in aggregates, the stuff that's outside of aggregates, the stuff that's in the aggregates within the aggregates, you know, and obviously that was interesting to look at those carbon pools because you got an idea of stability, right? But when is it like, when we're looking at increasing carbon in these systems that are intensively managed, when is a carbon number good enough for our understanding of that accumulation in that soil? And this, sorry to ask you this question, Jordan, but I'm curious. So love to hear what you think.
Totally fine. Yeah. I mean, soil carbon, you know, everyone always wants to know, oh, how much soil carbon is going to be there? And, you know, they want it yesterday. And the thing is with soil carbon, it takes a long time to build it. And I know there's a lot of industry demand, you know, and there's a lot of kind of hopes to make that go quicker. Now, this is where really long-term studies, like the stuff that universities have invested in, really comes in handy, and that longevity. So for example, here at University of Missouri, we have a really long-term experiment. It's been going for just south of 140 years, and they take deep soil samples every 25 years or so. And they're measuring, I think we have 30 different managements or something like that, and they measure how soil carbon accumulates over time, right? So you can pull from large data sets like that. You know, then you develop models, and then you say, one, what are the things that we actually need to measure? So carbon being one of them, but, you know, maybe we need other pieces of information. It's essentially, you know, able to use data to ask the question, what's the 80-20 here, right? What is the 20% of information that gives you 80% of the results? And so we use those types of resources to kind of triangulate. I understand how everyone wants to build soil carbon, and I'm really excited that everyone is coming to see how valuable soil is. But I also, you know, as a scientist and also as someone who's interested in improving our soils, I want to make sure that it's data driven. And I appreciate the enthusiasm. I want to get it right. And, you know, and there are people who are doing really good work on that, you know, and that is both private and university on developing those models that are robust, either at the regional or even national or global scales. You know, people are really working hard on that because there's a lot of interest. So, you know, we're working on it. Soil carbon, you know, on combustion, that number doesn't lie. I'll put it that way. That is the one soil health measurement to rule them all.
You know, what's the difference in these ideas of, like, you know, adding in this native biology, right, that may exist in our systems? You know, is there a difference between adding in native biology or new biology that may be kind of formulated and coming in the form of a jug? Or is it just better to build the biology that's there? What do you recommend?
You know, there's a lot of people out there with products that I affectionately, not pejoratively, call bug in a jug, as you were kind of referencing. And, you know, the idea is that, yeah, you're introducing some new biology, right? And that is well-intentioned. The thing that I like to maybe step back and ask is, why wasn't that there in the first place? If we go back to the soil carbon analogy, right, you're wanting to create conditions for the soil carbon to stick around. Similarly, if you have some sort of biology that you are wanting or not wanting, you need to create that selection pressure, if you will. Create the conditions that allow it to flourish. Adding the biology is just kind of throwing them in the deep end. You know, they may or may not survive, and it may or may not have the effect that you want. The more sure bet is to cultivate those conditions. And there's a lot of, you know, complexity within that.
And I know we often talk about how little we know about the biology itself, but where do we stand in our kind of knowledge of what you're just talking about is like the infrastructure to facilitate the biology? Does it feel like we're still just barely understanding that, or does it feel like we have a pretty good handle on it?
Good question. So both. In some ways, we have a good handle on it. You know, we know that when you lime your soils, you're really going to change it. Those kind of really big, blunt instruments, we know generally what they're going to do. Now, oftentimes we look back and we say, yeah, that makes sense. But it's harder for us to predict in a new context what's going to happen. And that's where, like, we are really in our nascency. There are a lot of really good soil microbiologists and soil ecologists who are, like, really, really looking at this very closely. But our predictive capacity is currently pretty low, you know, and part of that is in the ambiguity of how well do genes even relate to function sometimes. Some of it's at that level. And then some of it is then taking a step back and understanding how that environment influences it, let alone, you know, the thing that you are adding or changing about your system. And so layering all those in are really kind of, you know, it's complicated, and we might be able to, again, if we're a scientist and we go out and we do a study and we look backwards, we might say, oh yeah, makes sense, of course, right? But that doesn't mean that we can actually predict it when we go to a farmer's field with, you know, essentially new or no information. You know, that's the dream. And you have some research groups as well as, like, big companies really starting to try and tackle that at scale and bring big data approaches to bear upon that.
Okay, so Jordan, you've done some outreach. I don't think it's part of your appointment there in Missouri, but you enjoy getting out and talking about these things. For the people who are listening to this episode that are educators, right? My gosh, I hate even calling people educators, but who are sharing information about soil health with others. What would be one of the main messages that you would want them to take to farmers about soil health, whether it's testing or management, or what would be one of those primary messages?
Yeah. I hear you. You know, calling people soil health educators assumes that they have that knowledge already. Maybe we can call them soil health champions, right? People out there kind of on the ground, boots on the ground. The first thing to me is always that soil health is this huge world, right? It can mean all manner of things. And so to me, the first thing I always try and do, and I would recommend to others, is, like, to just listen. You know, what is the farmer telling you? They have some sort of on the ground understanding, both in terms of the problem and just, like, trends, you know, how things tend to go there. So that's the first thing, is just listen. I run a soil health test lab, but I am not a hammer in search of nails. I think that on the ground, in the field understanding of how things go is really important, right? And one thing with soil health or regenerative ag or however you want to think about it is that we have principles, right? And we try and apply those principles wherever it's relevant. We are not dogmatic, And so, you know, part of that is listening, understanding the problem, understanding how you can bring those principles to bear on that problem and on that context. So that's like maybe my first one. Second one is, you know, ask yourself about that context. Make sure that that context that you are maybe drawing from is relevant to the new one. As a story, so I did my bachelor's and master's out in California. I worked there, and those soils are lower organic matter, and you know, everything is irrigated, and water is the limiting resource. Then I went out for my PhD to Ohio, and it's kind of the opposite there. It's like, we got to wait for all this water to go away. And you know, understanding that context and how it really brings to bear or like influences that soil health really is important. You know, I could have gone out there and said, ah, well, you all should be applying compost and applying fertilizer through your drip tape. And they would have said, are what now? Like, we're not irrigating. We don't have drip tape. We have drainage tiles. We're trying to get rid of this stuff. And so that's, you know, how I generally like to counsel people to kind of, you know, listen and make sure that that context that you're bringing to bear upon it is actually applicable.
Well, this is maybe a hard question, so feel free to dodge it if you'd like. But in the coming decade, what's a question that you hope the field of soil science can answer that would have impactful implications for farmers?
That is a really good question. I think that the thing that I hope for soil health is to bring together those two values, right? Farmers care a lot about soils. The general public cares a lot about soils. And, you know, we want to kind of bring those values to life. And we still need to do it while, you know, feeding and providing fiber to the world. And I think that soil health represents a potential win-win. And we need to figure out how to communicate across that. And I think that soil health is a good kind of package for that, or regenerative ag. I think those two things go hand in hand. And I think that that kind of is a good package there, right? Presents a positive view of what we can have. And it also says, like, you know, we've maybe made mistakes in the past. We've made missteps, all of us. And this is a way to say, here's this positive future that we're working towards. That's really what I hope, is that it actually like brings people together and finally gives us a common language to use. Because, you know, 75% of land in the US is under some sort of agricultural management. Like, we can't just pretend like that's either inconsequential or that we should have less of that. You know, like, it is a good thing to have that land in production. And we need to make sure that we are having a shared language and methodology for making that as productive and as sustainable as possible.
All right, what a great interview there with Dr. Jordan Wade. I mean, no matter where you're listening to this episode, I think there's something relevant there, and I highly encourage you to go find out more about what they're doing at Missouri. We'll leave a link or two in the show notes so you can go dive deeper and learn more and check that out. Thanks so much to Jordan for taking the time, and thanks to Abby for co-hosting yet another episode with me here. Also, thanks to our sponsors of this season of Soil Sense: the North Central Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education Program, the North Dakota Corn Council, the North Dakota Wheat Commission, the North Dakota Soybean Council, the North Harvest Dry Bean Association, the North Dakota Barley Council, and Anheuser-Busch. If you're getting value from these podcasts, we'd love it if you'd leave us a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or both. And please share your favorite episodes on Twitter using the hashtag SoilSense. We'll be back with another episode of SoilSense next week.